So tonight, I'm going to talk about the beautiful breath, which might not be a surprise after that guided meditation. And some of the things that I did in that meditation might become a little clearer as I go along. So the beautiful breath, also known as the happy breath or the sweet breath, and I'm not talking about pranayama, which is the collection of yoga breath control practices. I will be talking about what it is, how you might be able to cultivate it, and how it might or might not help your practice. And I want to make a point right up front that we don't actually cultivate the beautiful breath. It's already there. We're simply cultivating the capacity to notice it. And I think that we don't notice it because we've become very familiar with the breath. The breath is very beautiful to somebody who has just spent a lot of time underwater and is gasping for breath once they get to the surface. But most of the time, we don't really think much about the breath. I've got a little bit of trepidation about this talk because nobody teaches this. Nobody teaches the beautiful breath directly as something that can be developed. I Googled for it. I could find no talks anywhere online about it. The beautiful breath often comes up in other contexts, and I'll touch on that as we go along. So a little bit of context. I want to say something about samatha practice in general. And I like the word samatha. It's often called concentration practice, and I use that word all the time, and I don't really like it much because concentration practice sounds like a lot of work. It always makes me think of that orange juice concentrate that came in those little cans, and you plop it into a big old pitcher and add water. And it looked to me like it must have been a really lot of work to squeeze all that orange juice into the little can. So when I think of concentration practice, to me, it sounds like a lot of work. And I think of samatha practice as being more of a process of letting go, of relaxing the mind, not trying to achieve something. So for instance, returning to the breath really is the practice. It's the core of the practice. It's learning how to let go of monkey mind. If you return to the breath 50 times in a sit, that's 50 times you've let go of the monkey mind. And when I first started sitting, every time I found that my mind wandered off into discursive thought, I'd start judging myself. I'd start thinking, oh, I'm a really crappy meditator. I was convinced I was the world's worst meditator. And I look back on that now and I think, wow, think of all those times where I was able to let go of monkey mind. So something I've been doing more recently is just noticing the sense of release, the sense of relief when I return to the breath, when I can let go of all that planning and all that fantasizing or whatever, and just go back to the breath. It's just a little sigh of relief there. Now, of course, I've been talking about the breath. There's a lot of other ways to do samatha practice. Breath is one of the most commonly used objects of meditation for samatha practice. There are others. There's a chant or a mantra. Transcendental meditation uses the mantra practice, very powerful. Visualization. I did some visualization in the guided sit. Visualization seems kind of weird when the imagination that I was trying to invoke was more about sensory feelings rather than sights, but various forms of visualization are used. Sound meditations like the neti sound, the sound of silence. That is, if you sit very still, you'll notice a high-pitched hum in your head. It's sort of like part of your neural wiring has this hum in it. This is not a good practice for people who have tinnitus, by the way. Another sound meditation is just sound in general. I have found sound meditation to be really good in busy train stations. You know, there's nothing else to do to wait for your train. And that the sound sort of turns into almost like ocean roar. And then there's gazing at a flame or a mandala or a kasina. Kasina practices shows up in the Visuddhimagga a lot. And that's the practice of looking at painted discs, usually a white disc. They come in other colors. And then there are various practices associated with concentrating around the visualization of that disc. I don't want to go into details. I've never tried it myself. I know people who have. The nice thing about the breath is it's easy to find. It's highly portable. You don't have to have a mandala or a candle. You don't have to memorize a mantra. So it's always available to you. Another thing is that it seems quite neutral in tone. It's not, at least when you're starting, it's not very pleasant or unpleasant. So in fact, breath is boring. So if you could focus on something that's that boring, you can focus on other things in your life. It's a really good practice for just learning how to focus on what you want to focus on, when you want to focus on it. The breath is not very good to meditate on necessarily for people with emphysema or COPD. For people who have trouble with the breath, it can be problematic. An interesting factor of the breath is it's kind of a bridge between the conscious and the unconscious. That is, you can hold your breath or you can do pranayama. You can huff and puff and do all kinds of interesting experiments with the breath. But the breath keeps up even when you're asleep or even when you're unconscious. It doesn't go away. You've been breathing since the day you were born, and you'll breathe up until your death. And a warning, of course, I know people who can't use the breath or can't even do samatha practice because the breath, focusing on the breath might exacerbate migraines. I know someone who has bad migraine problems when she does samatha practice. So what she does is a sort of a form of choiceless awareness, and it works very well for her. I don't want to go into details of what that is. I've talked about it other times. So the breath, the way the Buddha taught it. I want to touch on, actually, I don't want to go through all of it, but I want to talk about the Anapanasati Sutta, which is, do I have it here? It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's number 118 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And the etymology of Anapanasati is pretty simple. Ana and pana is inhale and exhale. And sati is wise or right. So it's just wise inhalation and exhalation. That's all. That's a big discourse. It's quite interesting. And it contains a lot of stuff. It's got a frame story. The Buddha shows up and it's sort of a monastic jamboree. There's groups of monks and nuns teaching each other stuff and meditating. And it just sounds like everybody's having a grand old time. The Buddha sits down and he gives a talk. And he covers a lot of things. He covers the seven awakening factors, for instance. He talks about the four foundations of mindfulness, as it's so often translated. I prefer four domains of mindfulness or four applications of mindfulness, because most of it is, he gives some instructions for establishing mindfulness, and then he gives four categories of ways you can focus your mindfulness in order to further your path to liberation. But the core of the Anapanasati Sutta is 16 lines, or four groups of four lines each. We call them the tetrads. Each group of four lines is a tetrad. And I'm not going to read them all, but I'm going to read sort of the intro going into the list, and then the first eight of them. And this is all about the breath. There is the case where a monk, having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree, or to an empty building, sits down, folding his legs crosswise, holding his body erect, and setting mindfulness to the fore. Always mindful, he breathes in, mindful, he breathes out. And then the first of the lines is, breathing in long, he knows I am breathing in long. Or breathing out long, he knows I am breathing out long. Or breathing in short, he knows I am breathing in short. Or breathing out short, he knows I am breathing out short. So this sounds pretty simple, but it actually isn't. Consider knowing that you are breathing is not just that you're aware of your breathing, it's you're knowing that you're knowing you're breathing. This is quite a practice in itself, the knowing that you're knowing. So it's not just noticing that you're breathing in short, it's noticing that you're noticing that you're breathing in short. The third line, he trains himself, breathing in, I experience the whole body. Breathing out, I experience the whole body. Four, he trains himself, breathing in, I calm the bodily formation. Breathing out, I calm the bodily formation. Now notice that the first two lines were just no's. Know you're breathing in, know you're breathing out. The third and fourth lines are trains. She trains herself, breathing in, I experience the whole body. She trains herself, breathing in, I calm the bodily formation. Even here, we're already getting to places where there's some debate about exactly what these lines mean. What does it mean to experience the whole body? Most people agree that it's experiencing the breath in the entire body. I think it can mean more than that. It can be, you can have a sensation of breathing in and out through the body as if you're no longer breathing through the mouth or the nose, but it's almost as if the air is coming and going, expanding and contracting with the breath. This is an interesting experience, and I know a number of people who've reported this. And other experiences that could be lumped under this experiencing the whole body. So let's go to the second tetrad, or the fifth line in the whole shebang. He trains himself, I will breathe in experiencing joy. He trains himself, I will breathe out experiencing joy. Now the word that's translated here into joy is the Pali word piti. Other translations use rapture. I will breathe in experiencing rapture. I will breathe out experiencing rapture. Come back to this. And the sixth line, she trains herself, I will breathe in experiencing pleasure. She trains herself, I will breathe out experiencing pleasure. And here the word for pleasure, the sukha word being translated into pleasure is sukha. It's also translated as happiness or contentment. And then the next line, the seventh line, is he trains himself, I will breathe in sensitive to mental formation. He trains himself, I will breathe out sensitive to mental formation. Eighth line, she trains herself, I will breathe in calming mental formation. She trains herself, I will breathe out calming mental formation. This is generally, but not always, understood to mean letting go of mental fabrications, of thinking, of ideas, of thoughts, of monkey mind, primarily. So that's the first eight lines of the 16 of the Anapanasati Sutta. You could spend a lot of time studying the Anapanasati Sutta. So more about rapture and pleasure. There are those lines back there of about experiencing rapture and experiencing happiness in the breath. So here's another extract from a sutta that I'll read. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya 5.28. This is just an excerpt. There is the case where a monk, quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure, born from withdrawal, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. He permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. So this is boilerplate. It's just one of the many nearly identical descriptions of first jhana. So I don't want to go much into what jhana. Jhanas are very deep absorption states, usually deeply ecstatic. And then there are five, although some people argue that there are only four, factors in jhana. And that all four of them are mentioned in the excerpt that I just read. There's rapture and pleasure. Remember, rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. That's piti is the rapture or joy. Sukha is the happiness or pleasure. There's also vitaka, aim, that's directed thought. Vichara, sustain, or evaluation or applied thought. I know Philip Moffat really likes to aim and sustain, and I find that very useful too. And then the fifth factor is ekagata, or one-pointedness or unification of mind, which I like better. Ajahn Sumedho says it's the universe is one-pointed, but it is, or the mind is single-pointed, but it's the single point that contains everything. So we've already been using vitaka and vichara, aim and sustain, even if we haven't been explicitly using those terms. You know, the placing the attention, sustaining the attention on the breath. And the piti and the sukha, the rapture and pleasure, like in the fifth and sixth lines of the Anapanasati Sutta, she trains herself, I will breathe in sensitive to rapture. She trains herself, I will breathe out sensitive to rapture. He trains himself, I will breathe in experiencing pleasure. He trains himself, I will breathe out experiencing pleasure. These are two different translations, using one using sensitive, one to experiencing. But the point I want to make here, which I think is really important, is they're not creating or achieving rapture. They're simply becoming aware of it. They're simply experiencing something that's already there. So back to the beautiful breath. It's been described by many teachers and practices and practitioners. It's something that arises naturally as samatha deepens. So teachers who work in the area of jhana practice often talk about the beautiful breath and how that can grow as the concentration practice deepens. The breath becomes much more interesting, of course, when it becomes pleasurable. So it becomes kind of a self-reinforcing loop. If you're breathing and the breath is pleasant, then the breath becomes a lot more interesting. It's a lot easier to stay with the breath. Makes sense. And the two components of the breath, of the beauty of the breath, of the pleasant aspect of the breath, are piti and sukha, the rapture and the happiness. And these can be very, very subtle at first. It can be kind of surprising when you first notice it, like, oh, wow, that's nice. Where'd that come from? So it can be very quite subtle. It can grow very, very strong. So can we cultivate it, or can we cultivate the awareness of it? So I said, as I said earlier, I have not seen this taught anywhere. So I think curiosity is hugely important here. This works for some people. Something else might work for you. So I'll talk about my own practice for PT. Notice that the actual teachers usually teach things that they have already experienced themselves. It's because they teach what they know. The problematic part of that, of course, is when a teacher, and I'm thinking of one or two teachers that I have run into, who have found a path to some particular experience, start teaching that, have some success, and declare publicly that that's the only legitimate path and everybody else are just fakers. So that's a danger of teaching what you know or what you've experienced. So my own practice for PT, and I first stumbled into this when Philip Moffitt gave a guided meditation, very similar to the one that I gave earlier. And I suddenly had this capability for producing a lot of PT, which I could go on retreat and focus a lot on it and give myself terrific headaches because I really didn't know what to do with it except produce tons of PT. But now when I want to come up with PT, if I like to produce it, I start with gratitude in the body. What does gratitude feel like in the body? Not as an idea or attitude, not even thinking of it as an emotion, but what is the felt physical sensation when I cultivate gratitude? And then I focus on the nostrils or the area in front of the nostrils. This is something where, and I've talked to Philip about this, he's also had this experience where you can feel like there's an energy body in front of the face. I know other people have experienced this too, probably some people in this virtual room. And then I visualize inhaling into the third eye area, which expands into sort of an open dome of awareness or this open sky of awareness. And I can find this fairly easily. There are times when I sit down and it just doesn't come to me at all. So, but about half the time when I want to summon Sukha, I can make this work. And this is something that I've, of course, been working on for like 18 or 19 years. For Sukha, what I found is if I exhale as if through the eye of the needle, releasing that energy down through the sinuses and through the nostrils, and just in a very focused way. And again, it's a visualization. It's using the imagination. And I find that this is a really good way. If the PD is happening, the Sukha also happens. And of course, what I have found really important for this for me is the use of the imaginative possible. This is a phrase that Philip Moffitt has used a lot in the past. So I want to take a little aside because I think imaginative possible is a hugely useful spiritual tool in practice. If there's an experience that's not immediately or obviously available, ask yourself what would it feel like if it was available? And not forcing, not striving, just opening to the possibility and using the imagination and becoming available to that experience. And of course, curiosity is really important because you have to open up to the possibility of this happening. If you're not curious about it, then you know you don't care. It's just not interesting enough. It's got to be sort of a almost like the curiosity creates a vacuum for the experience to occupy. So I think curiosity is really the core of any spiritual endeavor. I don't know how to cultivate curiosity. If you don't have it, seek it. So what are the benefits and some drawbacks of the beautiful breath? Well, as I suggested earlier, it can make samatha practice much more engaging very quickly. You can sit down at a retreat, and if the beautiful breath comes and it often doesn't, then it can make the breath very, very interesting. And it's much easier to stay with the breath and deepen the concentration quickly when the breath becomes intrinsically interesting. The samatha practice is one aspect of it, the simple deepening of one's concentration. But this is also particularly powerful in metta practice. I like to think when I'm practicing metta, breathe in gratitude, breathe out generosity. Breathing in piti, the rapture, which brings this energy. The thing about piti is that many people, when they become very familiar with it, find it actually kind of tiresome. Because at first, you know, got this almost like fountain of energy, like sparks. It can be quite, you know, there's a huge wow factor. And it can be exhausting. The sukha is much more of a melting happiness, a soothing quality to it. I remember Sally Armstrong once talking at a concentration retreat about how she'd been practicing for a while, and she said to her teacher, "Oh, do I have to go through more of this yucky piti?" She was, you know, getting really tired of rapture. So breathing in piti, bringing that energy, because it is a powerful energetic, even though it can be tiring. Breathing out sukha, feeling like radiant friendliness. I love the term radiant friendliness for metta practice because sukha feels like radiant friendliness. It just flows out, the well-wishing, the happiness. It's a relaxation, a release. So it goes really beautifully with the energy of the piti. Breathing in piti, breathing out sukha, radiating that energy with generosity. So breathe in gratitude, breathe out generosity. When you can feel this in the body as felt sensations rather than as these words, this can create a very powerful feedback loop. And the piti and the sukha can get stronger and stronger. Now, I said there's some drawbacks to this. There are some dangers. You can get wrapped up in enjoying the beautiful breath for its own sake rather than using it as a tool for deepening practice. It can feel like a shortcut. You can get near jhana. You can actually get near jhana quickly enough that you can become impatient. This has happened to me where I've actually developed neighborhood concentration so strong that I feel like jhana is just this close, but then I never get there because the concentration needs time to develop. That is, the beautiful breath can deepen the concentration quite a bit, but it won't take you all the way there. It won't take you to liberation, and it certainly won't take you to jhana. There needs to be time to develop the other factors. So if you practice with the beautiful breath, you have to be willing to spend a lot of time with the breath and without expectations. Anything pleasant in meditation can lead to one of the hindrances, greed and desire. You know, you have the beautiful breath, or say you don't have the beautiful breath and you really want it. You know, maybe you've had an experience of the beautiful breath. By the way, many people, I've talked about cultivating the beautiful breath, but the beautiful breath can develop quite naturally as concentration practice deepens over a period of time, like at a retreat. A lot of people will report after a number of days on, say, a concentration retreat. So a lot of people have had that experience of the beautiful breath, but you can have greed for it. You can want the beautiful breath when it's simply not available. I'll often sit down. It's just not there for me. It's completely dry. I have to let go of that and not crave the beautiful breath because that goes nowhere. So anything pleasant in meditation can lead to the hindrances. Wanting to experience jhana produces hindrances, and hindrances don't lead to jhana. I think all of us, I certainly have to remember that samatha leads to insight and wisdom. Samatha itself is not the goal. Now, we're not doing this just to go into deep states of concentration or to get good at concentration or to go into deep states of absorption. We're doing this to open up to our actual experience and to open up to the possibility of wisdom and insight. It's not a goal. Liberation is. Now, when samatha is strong, a lot of paths open up. The traditional teaching is that you can move towards jhana practice, or you can move towards vipassana practice. I think there are many other possibilities open. Because when samatha is strong, the noise from monkey mind really settles down. When you've been on retreat for a couple of days, you really notice this, that it really gets much more quiet. I once went on a 10-day retreat. I'd been on a 10-day retreat before and had some lovely experiences. Went on another 10-day retreat. After about 6 or 7 days, I was getting really impatient because I wasn't having those lovely experiences again. But then I suddenly stopped and realized, wow, it's really quiet up here. And then I stopped to enjoy that. And all of a sudden, I was having a great retreat. So this is why curiosity, I think, is so important. It's hard to have a fruitful practice without it. And the curiosity becomes a particularly powerful tool when the samatha is strong and the monkey mind is relatively still. And I know I'll think of more things to say later, but I think that's a good place to stop and ask for questions or comments. I can see everybody, so you don't have to use the raise hand icon. I see I lost a couple of people. Vita?
Yeah. Say something else about if it's not there, what would it be like if it was there, whatever mm-hmm. it is?
Right. Well, a good example, and I actually should have used this, but I will now. I remember Philip giving a talk on the imaginative possible many, many years ago in Turtle Island. And I, at that point, I was following the breath sort of the back of my throat. And I had read and heard from a couple of places that for concentration practice, it was recommended that you follow the breath at the nostrils or the upper lip. So I tried that, and I could not detect my breath there at all. I thought, this is wacky. This is silly. You know, how's that possible? But then I did a sit for about, 40-45 minute sit where I used the imaginative possible, where I imagined what would it feel like if I could feel the breath at the nose. And by the end of the sit, I was actually feeling the, and I wasn't imagining it. I wasn't making it up. I wasn't fabricating it. I was actually feeling the breath quite distinctly at the nose. And I like to say, I can feel my nose hairs twitching in the inhale and exhale. But I can very vividly sense that. So that's one example. I think any kind of experience that's not obviously available, a good way to try to access it is what would it feel like if you could feel it? And I think, I don't know if this is true. I'd like to believe that you can't actually fool yourself into experiencing something that isn't there. I think it's a good way of opening up to an experience that actually is there. I'd like to think it's not a tool for self-delusion. And I could be wrong. So that's another topic for curiosity. Liz. You're still muted, Liz.
Talking to you in my mind. What number Majjhima Nikaya is the Anasanapatthi?
Anapanasati. Let me scroll up here. I had it. Yes. It's 118. 118.
Okay. Also, it seems to me evident, and you may support this or not, one must really be on retreat to experience these deep states.
I think it's probably it's not impossible, I think. I don't get into very deep states when I'm doing home practice. I can access the beautiful breath at home, but when I first did access it, it was on a longer retreat. The thing about being on a retreat is it really gives you an opportunity to experiment with what works and what doesn't. One of the things about curiosity is that you have to experiment with what works and what doesn't work. I've given some suggestions for things that work for me. They may not work for you, but there may be other paths to similar experiences or other experiences that help you on your path, that help deepen your practice. So that's one of the benefits of a retreat, is just you have a lot of latitude for practice.
Thank you.
Mary.
I've been taking a couple of classes with Analia on the Anapanasati. But actually, a lot of these states are possible at home. Really following Analeo's instructions, and he's teaching a class in January on the book that he has, Mindfulness of Breathing, I believe, at Barry Center. Mm. So also Wisdom Publications has got a mindfulness class that it looks at this particular sutta in depth. So I've experienced pretty, fairly deep states at home, just really working on this particular sutta. So,
well, thanks. That is interesting news. And also, I need to follow Analeo more closely. So I will look at this in January, because obviously I didn't go deeply into the Anapanasati Sutta because I really don't have expertise there. But I would like to know more about that. And of course, he's such an amazing presence. I sat one retreat with him and it was quite an experience. Jan.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I've heard Ajahn Bam speak on beautiful breath. And I know that you had said there were no talks, but he's, I think he's even written a book on it.
I've read one of his books. I don't know if there's more than one. There are a number of books on the breathing practice that mention the beautiful breath, but all the, and I, at least the book that I read by Ajahn Brahm talked about beautiful breath as something that arose from concentration practice, but nothing specific about how to cultivate it. Now, if he has something about how to cultivate it, I'd love to find that. But I know that the beautiful breath is also mentioned in the book by Ajahn Buddhadasa. He's got two well-known books. One of them, less well-known, is also centered on the Anapanasati Sutta and talks about the beautiful breath. but nothing about how to cultivate it. And that's the one thing that I'd love to learn how to teach the beautiful breath. So this is partly why tonight's talk and guided sit is kind of an experiment.
Thank you for bringing it up. I'll go back and look at Ajahn Brahm's book and see if cultivation was something mentioned. Okay. The one that I read, The Bliss and Beyond, but I think he has one called Beautiful Breath.
Right. And I found talks on beautiful breath, but they were, they weren't about cultivating the beautiful breath. So yeah, please send me email. I'd love to know if, because I've only read one of his books and he may have examined that somewhere else.
If I find it, I will.
Great. Thank you. Mary.
So, Bill, thank you so much for the meditation and talk. One of the things that I have a problem with I talked to Philip about it too, is focusing on the third eye. And I think a lot of it stems from one of my first early practices of meditation. That was what they had us do, is focus on that. And I would give myself one hell of a headache. And sometimes not. And it was like interesting. It was like, I'm curious because I'm not entirely sure. I like the whole idea of letting go, because it was like, if there's a striving and a pushing, I go straight to headache. And you mentioned something about that too. I mean, it's really right. Like, you know, it's like, I feel like I'm trying to saw the top of my head off or something. Mm-hmm. And how, it's like, what do you use as an approach with the breath and the energy there to have it be, it has to be, for me, it has to be, not like I'm trying to blast that door open, but softer. Mm-hmm. And if you could give me some idea of guidance of what you use, if you're going to have that be a focus, that not to create that kind of that tension or whatever. So I'd be curious to hear what what you've done to make it work.
Well, you know, the initial guided sit that Philip did that had such an effect on me. He said he spent some time having people focusing on the ear, the location of the ear more, and mm-hmm. the experience of the ear, not of the hearing so much. And then used the third eye, not as a way, as a focus, but as a way to simply define a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And then to imagine sort of breathing up into the space above the plane.
Okay.
And I don't explicitly do that anymore, but I'm not focusing just narrowly in the third eye, but just pulling up into the area above the general eye area. So it's not terribly focused. It's really loosely held. Sometimes it feels as if I'm giving my eyeballs a warm bath when I inhale. Mm-hmm. So there are different things, kinds of sensations that I notice when I breathe in, but it's not narrowly focused on the third eye. Sometimes when I breathe out, I'll have a more narrow focus, but it's sort of like mm-hmm. down the front of the bridge of the nose rather than as if it's coming near the third eye. But so I think, as with anything else, hold these things very loosely because it sounds like when you think about the third eye, it's very easy to tighten in on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to go cross-eyed because it's almost like you want to look through the third eye. And then, yes, you could easily get a headache if you try to do that. So try to just, I think, enlarge the area that you're thinking of or imagining, if it were.
Imagining, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Nancy.
Bill, I've got two questions. Mm-hmm. One is, I'm not familiar with you. You and Mary both talked about Analio. I'm not familiar with that, who he is.
Inalio is a very interesting character who he was a martial arts punk in Berlin, and he ended up being well, I can't help but tell this story. He went to his martial arts teacher, and the teacher said, "Kid, you should meditate." And of course, this guy, this punk said, "Oh, I don't want to meditate. That's for panty waists." But he did meditate. You know, when you're in a martial arts discipline, when your teacher tells you to do something, you do it, including washing his car or whatever. So he meditated. He liked it so much. And obviously he has trouble with impulse control. He went immediately to Thailand, found himself a cave, and started meditating. And, you know, villagers would bring him food and stuff. So anyway, he doesn't know a whole lot about meditation yet, but he does it all. He loves it. But in Thailand, you have to leave every 3 months to get another visa to come back in. It's a tourist visa that only lasts 3 months. So he went to the nearest place where he could get the cheapest flight, which I think was Kuala Lumpur. And while he was there in the airport, somebody handed him a book called The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, I think is it. It's by, I'm blanking on his name. What?
Nanamoli.
Nanamoli, thank you. And who was a German-born guy who was living in Sri Lanka. So our gutter punk reads the book, completely is entranced by it, and decides he has to go to Sri Lanka to meet Nanamoli. So he goes to Sri Lanka. He gets to Sri Lanka and goes to the monastery where Nanamoli is, and finds Nanamoli died a few days earlier. He missed Nanamoli by just a few days. Nanamoli died young. So he went into Nanamoli's office, and he's looking at the office, and he just lifts up sort of a pad that's on top of the desk, and under it is one slip of paper. And on it is written in German, something about suffering. There are two kinds of suffering. There's the suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. And he saw this as a calling and decided to take over from Nanamoli. So, Inalio has become one of the principal translators of Pali, and he's also been researching the Chinese agamas, which are versions of the Pali canon that ended up in China. So he's been doing absolutely fascinating work. He has a number of books out, primarily on the Satipatthana Sutta, but he's done work, you know, throughout the Pali canon. He's an amazing presence, because when you sit a retreat with him, you go in the morning and he's sitting there. No cushions. He doesn't budge. You come and go during the day. He doesn't budge. He goes away, you know, in the middle of the day, comes back in the afternoon. He doesn't budge. The guy does not move all day long. And he's just an amazing speaker and a wonderful writer. Don't know how he writes as many books as he does, but he is an amazing presence. I recommend his stuff very highly. I don't have anything specific to recommend, because I've only read, at this point, only one of his books.
How do you spell the name?
Anamalio. So if you Google that, you'll find all kinds of references. Mary Page is holding up one of his books.
This is the one on the Anapanasati. It's called Mindfulness of Breathing.
Can you put that up to the camera a little bit more? Uh-huh. Okay.
And
okay. Oh.
He's an absolutely riveting teacher.
Sounds like it.
Brilliant teacher. Wonderful teacher. I'm taking classes with him right now.
So if you have a little trouble with breath, which I do sometimes because I have a slight bit of asthma. So, Bill, you didn't want to go into it, but are you suggesting switching your focus to choiceless awareness or to third eye or whatever?
Well, I would think
when you're dealing with breath a little bit, what do you recommend?
If you have trouble with breath, I really like choiceless awareness a lot. And it's good practice anyway. For me, it's something that I do quite often. It's a very different approach. I mean, another thing about the breath is try holding the breath looser, not trying to be as, you know, there may be a way to relax around it. But I recommend choiceless awareness anyway. And the way I like to do, and there are different ways people talk about it. What I like to do is sit down and sense all the physical experiences that I'm having. And what I do is something that I like to call catch and release. Just start noticing experiences. And each time I notice one, let go of my noticing that and move to something else, like, you know, buttocks on the chair, okay, hair on the nape of the neck, sound of a truck passing by, and lips pressed together. I do it faster than that because all I have to do is notice it and then open up to what else is there to notice. And just keep noticing.
Thank
you. Noticing experience arise.
Listen, after this is over, I have a question about trying to send something on chat. But after you've wrapped up things, I want to have some help with that.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Liz?
Yes, I'm curious about the concept of the third eye. Is that a legitimate concept in Buddhist practice? I have never, ever heard a teacher talk about it.
I've heard a couple of teachers talk about it in terms of a meditation practice, but you're right. It's not something that is in the suttas or in the Visuddhimagga. It's not.
I think of the third eye as woo-woo. This is woo-woo.
Yeah, right.
This has nothing to do with Buddhist practice. Analeo would never talk about the third eye.
You're absolutely right. And it is quite woo-woo. And the thing about what we're trying to do is we don't have a very good vocabulary for talking about some of these experiences. And the third eye has come up and has been around a long time in Vedic practice and Hindu practice. And I think for a good reason, that it's been useful to them as a meditation practice, not as a belief. It's not like I'm saying there is a third eye or that you get in contact with the gods through it or something like that. It's simply a useful visualization. And it's something that obviously it touches off nerves in some people because of the context in which it shows up. And also for some people like Mary, you can focus too much on it and cause a lot of strain. So I could probably describe what I was doing without using reference to the third eye. But, you know, it was Philip Moffat who first, you know, used it in our Buddhist Sangha context. So you can
never heard him, isn't it?
You can blame Philip for it.